10 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time. In the World Service of the BBC, this is Philip Cottrell with Newsdesk. The headlines: the Chinese authorities have burned hundreds of thousands of books and cassette tapes in their campaign against the Falun Gong religious sect. The Indonesian government says it has been informed by the United Nations that the referendum on autonomy for East Timor is to be delayed by another week. The Taliban authorities in Afghanistan have launched a major offensive against opposition forces. Representatives from over 100 countries and international organizations gather in Brussels today in a bid to find $300 million to pay for the most urgent humanitarian needs in Kosovo. Also in the program, Russia may get a new loan from the IMF, but how much would it actually help towards the recovery of its economy? The Chinese authorities have burned hundreds of thousands of books and tapes about Falun Gong, the quasi-religious movement banned by the government last week. As well as the burning of books, the Chinese authorities have also set up a site on the internet for posting government decisions and criticisms related to Falun Gong. David Willis reports from Beijing.
Police have raided homes and publishing houses in their effort to eradicate a group which claims 100 million members. State media says that in one city alone, Wuhan, security forces confiscated and then destroyed 130,000 books and 27,000 audio and videotapes. Police and paramilitaries have been drafted in to railway stations and bus depots to prevent members of the sect travelling to Beijing to protest. Falun Gong members deny they have political ambitions. The group condemns the commercialism and consumerism of modern China and encourages its members to engage in slow-motion yoga-type workouts, which are said to channel unseen forces. The group has followers in the Communist Party and the military, and many of them have now been sent for so-called re-education in Marxist ideology.
As we heard in David Willis's report, the Falun Gong movement says it has 100 million followers in China, compared with the Communist Party membership of 60 million. Our Beijing correspondent James Miles looks at the rapid growth of the cult and its implications for the Communist Party's grip on power.
The cult's figures may be exaggerated, but it's certainly got mass appeal. Its soothing yoga-like rituals performed to relaxing music offer peace and respite from the hurly-burly of life in a country that's changing at a frenetic pace. The Falun Gong sect also emphasizes moral values that many Chinese believe are being ignored by the Communist Party in its pursuit of economic goals. Falun Gong's millions of devotees display religious devotion to their New York-based leader, Li Hongzhi. It's hard to find any Chinese who show the same devotion to members of the Politburo. Dai Qing is a Beijing-based writer.
Right now in China, the situation is not so good. We have so many people lost their job in this country. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And just like in the history of China, the peasant rebel happened. So the leaders in China is really very, very worried about this situation.
The leadership is now trying to discredit Falun Gong with a barrage of propaganda aimed at showing that devotion to the cult can lead to insanity, suicide or murder. The official media are full of reports of people renouncing the sect, including even members of the Communist Party itself.
James Miles reporting from Beijing. Indonesia says it's been informed by the United Nations of a further delay in the referendum on autonomy for East Timor. The Foreign Minister, Ali Alatas, said the UN was proposing that the vote be held on August the 30th, a week later than scheduled. It's the second time the vote has been postponed because of fears for security in the territory. The UN is continuing to register voters to take part in the poll, which could lead to independence for East Timor 24 years after its invasion by Indonesian troops. The head of the UN mission in East Timor, Ian Martin, said his staff were working closely with the Indonesian police to bring about the necessary improvements in security. You're listening to Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC. Senior officials from more than 100 countries and organisations are meeting in Brussels to agree urgent humanitarian aid for Kosovo. It's the first big donors conference on Kosovo and is being asked to pledge around $300 million to cover the province's most pressing needs. The European Commission estimates that some 120,000 houses must be repaired and electricity restored before the severe Balkan winter arrives in 3 months' time. Roy Dickinson is a European Union spokesman in the Kosovo capital, Pristina.
First of all, we've got to get people through the winter, and that means emergency shelter, so plastic windows, plastic roofs and so on, and temporary heating. For the longer term reconstruction of just of houses, we're looking at a figure of over $1.2 billion. So for housing, what we're going to be doing is simply to import materials, wood, glass, tiles and so on, so that we can give people the materials to rebuild their own houses where possible.
Mr. Dickinson also told the BBC that much higher sums would be required to rebuild Kosovo's economy, repairing the province's infrastructure and manufacturing base. On Friday, President Clinton and other leaders will demonstrate their commitment to reconstruction in the Balkans at a summit in Sarajevo. But correspondents say that some governments in the area are sceptical about how long the international community's commitment will last. In Kosovo, the funerals of the 14 Serbs killed in an apparent reprisal attack near the village of Gratsko are taking place later today. An investigation into the murders is being carried out by NATO's peacekeeping force in Kosovo, KFOR. A KFOR spokesman told the BBC that four people are being questioned in connection with the killings, but he refused to give any more details. Our correspondent Paul Wood is in Pristina.
Although the official investigation has yet to reach a conclusion, villagers in Gračko are in no doubt who's responsible for the worst atrocity since NATO arrived in Kosovo. It was the Kosovo Liberation Army, they say, and the people who died were killed for the simple reason that they were Serbs. Whatever the truth of this, there seems little spirit of reconciliation or forgiveness among the ethnic Albanian refugees who've returned to the province. Among those I spoke to on the streets of Pristina, there was no sympathy for the 14 Serbs who were murdered. The reactions ranged from mocking triumph to bafflement that any Serbs could want or expect to remain behind in Kosovo after everything that had happened to the ethnic Albanian population here. NATO, though, says it's determined that Kosovo will retain its multi-ethnic character, and it set itself the task of hunting down the Gračko killers. Several leads are apparently being followed, and while the investigation continues, KFOR's trying to bring together Serb and Albanian farmers in Gračko in a cooperative which will work under NATO protection. The scheme was thought of by an American army major with a farming background. But at a first meeting yesterday, the Serb and Albanian farmers would not look at each other, let alone speak.
One of the main Serbian opposition leaders, Zoran Djindjic, is appearing before a military tribunal today to answer charges of avoiding a military call-up during the Kosovo War. Mr. Djindjic was in Montenegro, Serbia's smaller partner in the Yugoslav Federation, during the NATO bombardment, and he says he did not receive call-up papers. Mr. Djindjic and his Alliance for Change say the charges are politically motivated. Mike Gallagher from our news staff looks at Mr. Djindjic's role as a leading opponent of the Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic.
Celebrations 2 years ago, as Belgrade welcomed its first non-communist mayor in half a century, Zoran Djindjic. Having held street protests for 3 months, he and his opposition allies had forced a reluctant Slobodan Milosevic to accept their local election triumphs. And Mr. Djindjic was sure this was the start of greater things to come.
We will not resolve our problems just by going into this or any other city assemblies. We will resolve our problems when the yardstick for freedom and democracy, which has been established here, becomes the law throughout Serbia.
Zoran Djindjic came to prominence in 1974, when, as a student, he tried to establish a student union outside Communist Party control. He ended up in jail and later finished his studies in Germany, gaining a doctorate in philosophy. He co-founded the Democratic Party in 1990, becoming its leader 2 years later, and wrote passionately against the emerging Serb nationalism. Aged 46, he's seen as a pro-Western, an intellectual, and a reformer. But as Balkan expert Christopher Svic explains, he's also a political chameleon.
I think that Djindjic is a sincerely European politician. He is a European-style liberal in the Serbian context, but he has had to play games with Serbian nationalism. He has been friendly with the regime in Pale, in Bosnia, with Karadzic and Mladic. He has criticized Milosevic over making concessions to the West in Bosnia. And this has certainly shown that he is a bit of an opportunist.
Only in 1995, after the Dayton Peace Accord for Bosnia, did Mr. Djindjic return to his earlier rhetoric, calling for social change and freedom of information.
Mike Gallagher reporting. The NATO commander, General Wesley Clark, is to leave his post 3 months ahead of schedule. A spokesman for the United States Defense Department said General Clark's early departure was not a result of dissatisfaction with his performance during the 11-week war against Yugoslavia, but part of a rotation of American senior ranks. He'll be replaced by his fellow American general, Joseph Ralston. Correspondents say General Clark had consistently urged more aggressive tactics during the air campaign, including the possibility of a ground invasion of the province of Kosovo, and his stance had caused tension with the American High Command. You're listening to Newsdesk in the World Service of the BBC. A reminder of today's headline: the Chinese authorities have burned hundreds of thousands of books and cassette tapes in their campaign against the Falun Gong religious sect. Later in the programme, Russia's hopes for a new IMF loan. But will that mean new money to its economy? More details are emerging about the 18 adventure sport enthusiasts killed in Switzerland as they traversed a mountain stream without rafts. A Swiss diplomat says the dead include holidaymakers from Australia, New Zealand, the United States, Britain and France. They've not yet been named. At least one person is still missing and six others were injured in the accident, which police say involved 36 tourists in four teams, each one led by two guides. Reports say the adventure party was caught by a sudden rush of water in a mountain stream near the resort of Interlaken following violent storms. Anne Hall is the mother of one of those who survived.
He said that they'd been involved in this adventure of abseiling and into the canyon, and that just a massive wall of water had come down and just swept them all away. He said that he was just turned over and over in the water. He said he went down about six waterfalls. He said he felt his back break. I don't know. We don't actually have confirmation of whether he has actually broken his back. He can move his legs, so he's not paralysed, which is something.
France has been found guilty of torture by the European Court of Human Rights, the first time this has happened to a European Union country. The court ruled that the treatment by French police of a drug dealer, Ahmed Selmouni, 8 years ago, was of particularly cruel and serious nature. The court said it violated the European Convention of Human Rights and awarded Mr. Selmouni $75,000 in damages. Mr. Selmouni, who's serving a 13-year sentence in a French prison, said police beat him up, crushed his toes, and sexually abused him after his arrest on heroin smuggling charges in November 1991. Protestant politicians in Northern Ireland say they are concerned about the implications of a series of arrests in the United States and the Irish Republic in connection with a suspected plot to smuggle weapons. A spokesman for Northern Ireland's main Protestant party, the Ulster Unionists, said the arrests added to fears of a continuing threat from terrorism. Four alleged supporters of the IRA were arrested in the United States after guns and ammunition brought there were posted to an address in the Irish Republic. In another development, police in the Irish Republic arrested three people after handguns were found in the western city of Galway. Reports say the arrests were connected with the alleged shipment of weapons from the United States. The Taliban in Afghanistan launched a major offensive against opposition forces northeast of the capital, Kabul. The attack on two fronts against the forces of the opposition commander, Ahmed Shah Massoud, comes a week after the latest United Nations-sponsored peace talks ended in failure. Early reports say the Taliban attacked opposition forces in the Tagab Valley, 70 kilometres northeast of Kabul. From Kabul, William Reeve reports.
The Taliban's offensive comes as no surprise. Both sides in the Afghan conflict have been building up arms supplies for many months. Since last week, when the peace talks in Tashkent ended with no result, there have been strong signs that an offensive was imminent. Unconfirmed reports say the Taliban have advanced 2 kilometres along the Tagaw Valley, and that on the other front they've taken some high ground. There are no reports yet of the scale of casualties. This morning, three rockets, fired by the anti-Taliban forces, landed on Kabul airport. There are no reports of damage, but the anti-Taliban alliance accuses its opponents of using the airport to launch airstrikes against its positions. There have been no major offensives in Afghanistan for 10 months. Last August, the Taliban captured much of North Afghanistan, and in September, the Central Highlands region of the country. Since then, there's been further fighting in central Afghanistan, which is now held by the Taliban, and also along other points along the front lines, which are mainly in the northeast of the country. The Taliban's main opponent is the veteran commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud.
William Reeve in Kabul. A team of United Nations experts in Iraq has destroyed a small amount of VX nerve gas left behind by UN weapons inspectors when they withdrew from Baghdad last year. The presence of the samples in a UN laboratory had created a controversy. Iraq and Russia suggested that UN weapons inspectors might have used the nerve gas to contaminate Iraqi warheads in order to justify American and British airstrikes at the end of last year. The UN inspectors rejected the allegation, and the UN Security Council finally ordered the samples to be destroyed. The Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak has said after his first substantive talks with the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat that he remains committed to implementing the Y Accords on further Israeli withdrawals from the occupied territories. But he tried to persuade Mr. Arafat to agree to delay full implementation until a final peace deal is reached. He said Mr. Arafat agreed to consider his suggestions. But the Palestinian leader stuck to his original position and enlisted the various commitments that he expects the Israelis to fulfil, including withdrawals and prisoner releases. However, the BBC Jerusalem correspondent says that from the cordial tone after the meeting, it looks as if the two sides are trying hard to work together. An international conference on Sierra Leone is taking place in London today, aiming to cement the current peace process and find sources of funding to cope with the aftermath of the civil war. Among those attending are the Sierra Leone President, Ahmed Tijan Kaba, and representatives of the United Nations and the World Bank. British officials say the conference will enable the international community to help Sierra Leone recover from 8 years of conflict, as Caroline Hawley reports.
Many of the key players behind the Lomé Peace Accord are taking part in today's meeting. British officials say they're here to help sustain the momentum towards peace and decide what steps the international community should take next. As always, one of the main priorities will be finding the money to make the agreement work. 8 years of civil war have devastated Sierra Leone. Nearly half the country's population is thought to have been displaced, and thousands of civilians have lost limbs in brutal rebel attacks. In the worst affected areas, whole villages have been burned to the ground. The United Nations recently put Sierra Leone bottom of its list that ranks how countries are meeting the needs of their people. The peace agreement signed earlier this month should enable Sierra Leone to begin to address these massive needs. Britain is expected to announce new pledges of aid to help pay for Sierra Leone's reconstruction and for the disarmament and demobilisation of rebel fighters. Hundreds of former rebels have already arrived in the capital, Freetown, and Sierra Leone now wants the international community to help ensure they don't take their weapons back to the bush.
Caroline Hawley. The recent bitter fighting between Ethiopia and Eritrea, which has led to tens of thousands of deaths, appears to be drawing formally to a close. The two countries signed a ceasefire agreement earlier this month, and they're now expected to be sending delegations to Algeria to work out the technical details of the agreement. Haile Menkarios is Eritrea's permanent representative to the United Nations. He told the BBC that there are definite signs that that his country and Ethiopia can reconcile their differences in the years to come.
Sooner or later, I think if peace is established, then more bitter wars than this have been fought, you know, in Europe, elsewhere, let alone with the people who are very close to each other and need each other, actually, in those areas also. The wounds of war have been forgotten because greater interests sort of tie people together.
Eritrea's representative at the UN, Haile Menkarios. A United Nations envoy has called on Guatemala to tighten up its adoption laws to curb child trafficking and child prostitution. The envoy, Ofelia Calcetas Santos, who's been touring Guatemala, said that there were signs that senior officials, including government employees, politicians, and wives of military officers, were involved in the adoption trade. As our correspondent Peter Grester reports, both child prostitution and baby selling are booming in the wake of the country's 36-year civil war.
According to the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, Guatemala handled almost 1,350 adoptions last year. the vast bulk of those babies going to parents in the United States, Canada, France and Britain. Some of the adoptions are considered legitimate and above board, but many more were part of a thriving and unscrupulous adoption industry. It's the booming trade in babies that's prompted the Guatemalan government to invite Ofelia Calceta Santos to investigate the problem and to recommend ways of controlling adoptions. In a news conference in Guatemala City, the investigator said the government needed to enforce stricter controls, and she called on the authorities to take an active role in protecting children. But the problem seems to be endemic in the Central American state and may need more than just straightforward legislation. Asked if she could confirm allegations that senior government officials were involved in the trade, she simply replied, yes, without elaborating. Both the adoption trade and child prostitution has boomed in Guatemala ever since the country's bloody 36-year civil war ended in 1996. The war left lenient adoption laws, extreme poverty and a wave of orphans, all the ingredients necessary for both child prostitution and a baby trade to flourish. Desperate and childless foreign couples pay as much as $20,000 in fees for a baby. The natural Guatemalan mother gets around $100, with the brokers raking in a vast profit.
Peter Gresta in Mexico City. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. It's 10:21 Greenwich Mean Time. The International Monetary Fund meets in Washington later today to decide whether to resume loans to Russia, which it suspended nearly a year ago after the country defaulted on some of its debts. The meeting is widely expected to approve a loan of $4.5 billion. The Russians have been hoping for this for months, but the amount is tiny compared to their overall debts. Here's our business reporter Mark Fisher.
The Russian government will regard a resumption of IMF lending as a triumph. It hopes it will be seen as an international seal of approval for its economic policies, which could help it reschedule the huge debts that it owes to foreign governments and banks. This in turn could help revive its economy, which plunged into crisis last August. To secure the IMF loan, the government has worked hard to persuade Parliament to back austerity measures demanded by the IMF, even though it knows many of them are unpopular with the public. But an IMF loan would be just a starting point for solving Russia's problems. The amount of the loan it hopes to get is far less than the amount Russia already owes the IMF from past borrowings. So any money notionally handed over to the Russians now might simply be kept by the IMF to help satisfy that debt. The IMF is also known to be concerned about the way Russia has handled loans in the past, which has included some unexplained shuffling of money through an offshore financial centre. But Russia argues that an IMF deal should give it more credibility in talks with other creditors, to whom it owes a total of about $140 billion. On Thursday, it's due to meet some of them in talks in Paris, and it's already said it wants the debts to be comprehensively rescheduled.
The World Bank has announced that its lending over the past year reached a record level of $29 billion. For more on that and the rest of the business news, here's Sally Hardcastle.
The bank's main lending arm, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, approved loans worth $22.2 billion. The remaining $6.8 billion was made through the International Development Association, which lends funds at cheaper interest rates to poorer nations. Countries in East Asia and the Pacific region were the main beneficiaries. As East Asia attempted to emerge from its economic crisis, it received a total of nearly $10 billion in loans. The World Bank also had to step in to help countries in Latin America and the Caribbean cope with the sometimes devastating effects of Hurricane Mitch. The bank's president, James Wolfenson, says that while financial crises around the world have resulted in record lending, he's cheered by the way loans have led to good results on the ground. Markets. London's 100 share index is up 26 at 62.88. In Tokyo, the Nikkei index rose 117 to 17,579. The dollar's worth 115.8 Japanese yen. The euro's at $1.06.2. And the pound is worth $1.58.9.
To sport now. India have a new cricket captain, and Muhammad Ali has thrown his support behind a new bill aimed at protecting young boxers. The details from Alex Capstick.
He'd been widely tipped to take over, so it was no surprise when India's cricket selectors named Sachin Tendulkar as the new captain. He replaces Mohammad Azharuddin, whose second spell in charge had lasted just under 2 years. This is also the second time around for Tendulkar, who spent a year at the helm in 1997. From Bombay, Harshab Bogle reports.
It has long been said, and it isn't untrue, that the announcement of India's cricket captain means more to the country than the announcement of a new cabinet. And so, after enormous media speculation, Sachin Tendulkar now has one of the nation's most high-profile jobs. He is in many ways now the custodian of a country's hopes. It had been clear for a while that India were ready for a change. Azharuddin had the job for almost 2 years in his second innings and 7 in his first. But his recent form has been indifferent, and 5 months past his 36th birthday, he isn't getting younger. Tendulkar's appointment, therefore, is a clear direction to the future.
Pakistan's suspended cricket captain Wasim Akram has arrived home, where he'll be questioned about the match-fixing allegations. He's agreed to appear before the government panel set up to investigate the claims, along with teammates Ejaz Ahmed and Salim Malik. Wasim, regarded as one of the world's greatest players, is accused of having paid Ato Rahman $2,000 to bowl badly in a one-day international against New Zealand in 1994. The United States Senate has approved a bill to protect boxers from unscrupulous promoters and help young fighters take control of their lives. It has the support of the former world heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali. Richie Stevens reports.
The bill, which was approved by a voice vote without a debate, would set guidelines and force promoters to disclose charges, costs and fees they take from a boxer's winnings. Professional boxing in the United States has been under fire there for years from many lawmakers who object to alleged contract abuses, which they say makes promoters, managers and broadcasters rich at the expense of fighters. Pressure for Congress to act increased after the controversial world heavyweight title fight between Evander Holyfield and Lennox Lewis last March. Many experts thought that Lewis had won on points, though the three judges called it a draw.
And finally, one of the world's top golfers, David Duval, says up to 8 players from the United States could boycott this year's Ryder Cup unless they are paid. The biannual event against Europe begins in Boston on September the 24th. And that's the sport.
The American space shuttle Columbia has returned safely to Earth after placing an X-ray telescope into orbit. The 4-day mission was led by Eileen Collins, the first woman to command an American spacecraft. Her mission was welcomed by NASA after a rare night landing at Cape Canaveral.
Roger Realsap, Columbia, welcome home. Eileen, to you and the crew, just an outstanding job deploying Chandra and bringing Columbia home for a beautiful landing. There are no deltas.
Following the landing, NASA will be taking a close look at parts of Columbia. They say they'll be examining pipes which caused a hydrogen leak shortly after takeoff. The leak meant that Columbia was unable to reach its proper orbit, although it was still able to complete its main mission, as Toby Murcott of our science staff reports.
The puff of smoke as Columbia's tires hit the tarmac marked the end of a space flight that at one point seemed like it would never leave the ground. The first launch was delayed by a false alarm, and the second attempt by a series of thunderstorms over Florida. The shuttle finally took off on the third attempt, although a minor malfunction in Columbia's main engines meant the spacecraft burnt its supply of hydrogen fuel too fast and ended up 11 kilometers short of its intended orbit. However, the orbit was high enough to carry out the main part of the mission, launching the gigantic Chandra X-ray telescope. This was the largest payload ever carried into space on board a shuttle. And Chandra will spend the next 5 years in orbit, gathering information on some of the most violent explosions and energetic objects in the universe, black holes, supernovae and quasars. The Chandra telescope has been waiting over a year for a shuttle flight into orbit, and scientists will have to wait a little longer as the complex instrument is carefully activated.
Toby Murcott. Well, now to End News Desk, here are the main points again. The Chinese authorities have burned hundreds of thousands of books and tapes about Falun Gong, the quasi-religious movement banned by the government last week. They said that in the industrial city of Wuhan alone, they'd destroyed 130,000 books and 27,000 audio and videotapes. Indonesia says it's been informed by the United Nations of a further delay in the referendum on autonomy for East Timor. The foreign minister said the UN was proposing that the vote would be held on August the 30th, a week later than scheduled. A week after Afghan peace talks ended without result, renewed fighting is going on inside the country. The Taliban movement, which controls most of Afghanistan, has launched an offensive against the forces of its main opponent, Ahmad Shah Massoud. And representatives from over 100 countries and international organizations gather in Brussels today to try to find $300 million to pay for the most urgent humanitarian needs in Kosovo. Those are the headlines, and that's the end of News Desk.